Welcome to the meeting. Today I officially call the meeting of the Transportation Finance Committee to order. It is that time of the day. As you can see from the agenda, we have a very aggressive agenda today with six testifiers here that's going to give us our first initiation into autonomous vehicles. And I'm expecting that we will have more discussions about this throughout this session here. But we have over 22 states that have already started working on this and five others that have executive orders. And so you'll find lots of good information in your packet. Because of the aggressive state here, we are going to limit our testimony to a half an hour for MnDOT and the other presenters about 15 minutes. And so we will hold up a card at 2 minutes if you to give you that time. If there are additional questions that we don't get to during this presentation, please submit them in writing. We'll get them out to the individuals and have them answered. And, again, we will try to have – this is just our first meeting, but it will give us a really good start with that. So first, we're going to welcome MnDOT Representative Jay, and if I pronounce this wrong, Hippus, as the director. Please welcome. Identify yourself and present your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representative of the committee. My name is Jay Hippus. I am the state traffic engineer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thank you for having us here today. I'm going to start out by just giving you a little bit of a presentation overview. I'm going to talk about exactly what connected an autonomous vehicle is. We're all on the same page with some of the terminology. A little bit of an overview of some activities to date that MnDOT and our private partners and our sister agencies have conducted. And at the end, kind of wrap it up with a review of the executive order that was signed by Governor Dayton earlier this week. You hear the term connected vehicle, autonomous vehicle, automated vehicle. These terms are sometimes used interchangeably, but they are actually different. If you hear the term autonomous vehicle, it's a vehicle that can basically act by itself. So it's not relying on other cars to communicate with it. It's not relying on the infrastructure to communicate with it. It's relying on its own technology and sensors to drive down the roadway. A connected vehicle is a little bit the opposite. It is communicating with other vehicles. For example, in the future, vehicles may have technology where they're both approaching an intersection and they can be communicating so they don't crash. Technology that's being used right now is in truck platooning, where trucks are able to go a little bit closer space. They're using short-range radios to communicate with each other. So when one vehicle accelerates, the back vehicle accelerates automatically and they decelerate at the same time for fuel efficiencies. They're also, a connected vehicle also talks to our infrastructure, too. So when you have these vehicles and are approaching a signal or a stoplight, in the future, we could be communicating with a signal on, I'm red, I'm turning green in 5 seconds, or they're also communicating with other vehicles at the same time. Ideally, these two worlds come together and you have an automated connected vehicle where they're actually able to work independently but yet communicate with other vehicles and infrastructure when needed. You hear about different ranges of autonomy. Basically, there's 0 to 5, and these are kind of the standards, and I won't go into a lot of detail, but a level 0 vehicle is basically where the human driver has to do everything. And a level 5 vehicle is a vehicle where you could get in and say, take me to Grandma's house, and it will take you to Grandma's house. You don't need to do anything as a driver. A lot of these cars may, in the future, may not even have steering wheels and pedals. Many of you may have saw our autonomous shuttle project that we had. It was outside the Capitol yesterday. That was actually a level 4 vehicle. So that vehicle, if you got inside, had no steering wheel, no pedals. But if you said, take me to Grandma's house, it didn't know how to get there, it would just go around the loop that was already pre-programmed. So those vehicles have kind of limited range and technology and what they can actually do. There are some vehicles on the roadway that have kind of the 1s, 2s, and 3s. If you have cruise control on your car, that's a level of automation. Adaptive cruise control on some vehicles that are commercially available today where you're driving down the road and it will adjust the speed automatically. Some high-level cars, if they're operating in a freeway system, the driver can actually take their hands off the wheel and the vehicle knows to stay between the lanes and accelerate and decelerate with other vehicles. So some of this technology is actually out on the roadway right now, and that's why we use the term automated and not necessarily autonomous all the time. It's a progression of technology, and the technology is going to continue to grow and grow and grow and build off each other. And ultimately, someday, maybe we'll have a level 5 vehicle operating on our system. So we're talking about automated and connected vehicles. But there's other items that we're looking at, too, as a state. Truck platooning. Many states have adopted legislation on truck platooning. We're also working with our neighboring states around us to make sure that when we do have truck platooning laws and regulations, that they're consistent between states. Because a lot of interstate commerce, of course, the truck drivers don't want to have to deal with regulations that they cross state lines. Truck platooning is very beneficial from the industry standpoint. There's fuel efficiencies anywhere from 7 to 10% that's being reported right now by being able to drive at a closer distance to the truck in front. We're also looking at the impact of electrification of vehicles. Many vehicles now are going to electric, and what are the impacts of that on our system? Automated delivery services is also one item we're considering. You heard about Amazon drones a while ago. Many companies are actually developing vehicles that can deliver this. This is a vehicle that was out in California, and it's basically a little cooler on wheels, and it can navigate pedestrians on sidewalks and knows where to go. It gets to the delivery spot, you type in a code, and out comes your package. So these are being tested in some areas right now around the country. And the last one is mobility as a service. There's different models of what actually might happen with automated vehicles in the future. Some individuals say that we'll still all own cars. Other models are you won't own a car and everything will be a shared vehicle and the vehicles will be circulating at all times. So there's a wide range of possibilities that could happen. So we're looking at what happens if we have different models in the future and what does that do to our infrastructure and our capacity of our roadways. I get a question of how real is it and how fast is it going to come? It's difficult to predict when the technology is going to be ready for our roadways. They're doing a lot of testing in warm weather states, but not a lot is happening in cold weather states. So even though they're solving a lot of those challenges right now, there's a whole other set of challenges when you come north. But these are just some snapshots of some news clippings that are out there right now. When you see GM making bold statements about having a car with no steering wheels or pedals by 2019, you know that they're making some serious investments. Now, this car is probably not going to be commercially available on the street, but they are investing in the research. Same thing that there's platooning happening in Oregon. Michigan has done some platooning. I think there's a talk later on with Peloton and some of their technologies. And, of course, Uber is getting ready to buy fleets at the same time. So there's a lot of what's being driven here by the private industry. And in Minnesota, we just want to be ready because we know the technology is coming at a very fast pace, but we don't know exactly when it's going to be here. What are the impacts to Minnesota? There's a lot of impacts to Minnesota, both opportunities and threats. Safety is probably the biggest one for us. Each year we have over 300 people tragically killed on Minnesota roadways, and over 90% of those fatalities are due to some kind of human element. If you think about an automated vehicle, it doesn't drive drunk, it doesn't drive distracted. We think that we're going to be able to really turn the curve and maybe hit our goal of towards zero deaths with adding some autonomous vehicle or automated vehicles to our fleets in the future. We were fortunate last year to have our lowest number of fatalities since World War II, but we still have a long ways to go. We also think there's going to be some changes in operations. We're not really sure what the impact is going to be to congestion. If one of those models is true or vehicles are circulating all day, what does that mean in terms of number of vehicles on the street, and how would congestion either increase or decrease with automated vehicles? There's also potential for infrastructure changes. If these vehicles are relying on better pavement markings or special signs, or our signal systems need to be communicating with them and we have to exchange a lot of data, there's some infrastructure implications with preparing for these vehicles at the same time. Our regulations never ever contemplated automated or connected vehicles. We are starting to look at what our current legal framework is and what we can actually do for testing and deploying these vehicles in the future. I think Joan Wilshire is testifying later on about mobility opportunities, but we've been working very closely with the disabled community, and they are very excited about the opportunities of an automated vehicle. People right now who have to rely on others to have them transported can't wait for the day where they can actually have their own vehicle and take them to where they want to go and not rely on others. We also think there's great opportunities for businesses, not only maybe in attracting technology companies, but just overall increasing the business climate in Minnesota. If you look at what Colorado did with their Amazon headquarters application, they actually addressed transportation and how connected and automated vehicles and their vision may actually be a benefit for attracting that business to Colorado. So things that we need to be thinking about here, too, that we're competitive in that global environment. As I said earlier, there's a lot of things happening in the South, but we have those big challenges of snow and ice and salt. So these are some of the things that we really want to get interested in as things are happening on the national scale, international scale, and federal policies being passed. Minnesota needs to know how these vehicles operate in our winter winter weather conditions. As we started looking at this about a year or so ago, one of the things we've been looking at recently is some guidance that the federal government put out. See, this is not just a Minnesota issue, it's a national issue, and many manufacturers want to make sure that states are not developing laws which make it difficult to either develop vehicles or run vehicles on our roadways. So the federal government, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is basically the group that regulates vehicles, put out some guidance in September 2017. So I just want to highlight, this is a pretty thick document, but just highlight two key areas that I thought the committee would be interested in. One is the best practices for state agencies, and they recommend that we form a jurisdictional committee made up of a certain number of agencies to start looking at our laws and our regulations, and are they accommodating or not accommodating for the testing and deployment of these vehicles. At the same time, they also have some best practices for legislators. And some of the practices that they recommend is do not place unnecessary burden on competition or innovation. They really want innovation to be spurred and not really hindered by unnecessary regulation or overregulation, and to support the agencies in the testing and deployment of these vehicles. So with that guidance from the federal government, about a year or so ago, we convened a group that included MnDOT, our partners at Department of Public Safety, which includes State Patrol, Department of Commerce to address insurance, Metropolitan Council to address transit, and the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. So we've had a few meetings just talking about what we need to do, what our vision should be for the short term, if somebody did approach us and wanted to do a test or a deployment. And then we also recognize that we need to look at our long-term regulations on who's able to drive a vehicle, who can get a license, what does insurance look like, what do our traffic laws need to look like when you have a mixture of non-autonomous vehicles and autonomous vehicles operating in the same space. MnDOT has started to do some early testing and deployments. This is a shuttle project that we had. This is called a Easy Mile Shuttle. It is a level 4 electric automated vehicle. It was outside the Capitol yesterday if you had a chance to ride it. We also had it up at our Min Road facility earlier this year. We ran it through a series of cold weather tests. We're one of the first people in the world to actually do a extreme cold weather test on these vehicles. We ran it through some pretty harsh conditions. Both Mother Nature cooperated this year with us with some extreme weather, and we also had the capability of making certain snow conditions and testing. So we entered this project with a few different goals. One was to see how these vehicles react in snow and ice. One, to identify what they need to react or work with on our infrastructure so we're able to support that and plan for our infrastructure investments. How these vehicles would operate on our roadway. One of the reasons why we picked a shuttle, because it's not a MnDOT vehicle, a snowplow. So we learned a lot by having what a third party would be operating on our system. How do we increase those mobility options in the future? Increase Minnesota's influence. Say we were really getting concerned when federal rules and regulations were getting passed and they were not considering the northern states. So by having this project, MnDOT is now at the table with our partners from other states, and we're able to influence national regulations. We also are developing partnerships. This is some non-traditional partners that we typically don't deal with in terms of software vendors like BSI is here today. We're dealing directly with automobile manufacturers. So developing those partnerships to have a better understanding of what are the risks and what are the challenges with implementing this technology. And finally, to give the public a chance to see the vehicles and get their reaction. This is new. It's transformational. And the more input we can get from the public on what they like or the concerns are, the more we'll be prepared for when these vehicles arrive. In addition to our Min Road test, we ran through a bunch of safety tests to make sure it was safe to operate in a public environment. We brought it downtown Minneapolis the weekend before the Super Bowl. We closed off a block of Nicollet Mall. This vehicle is actually not able to legally operate on a public roadway with other traffic unless you get federal government exemptions. So we closed down a block of Nicollet Mall. And over a three-day period, we had over 1,300 people ride the shuttle. So we do it in six people increments. So a lot of the public was interested in coming down to ride the shuttle. We gave each person a card and asked them to comment on what their thoughts and perspectives were about the vehicle and the demonstration. We had a relatively small sample size return, but overwhelmingly, 82% of people said they were excited about having this technology on the roadways. 11% were kind of not sure and thought maybe we should have separate lanes for them in the future, and 7% were no. Some of the no's mostly revolved around cybersecurity and what happens if somebody hacks this vehicle and tries to take it over, which is a big issue that's being addressed not only here in Minnesota, but on a national, international scale too, is cybersecurity. This chart kind of shows what the chair was mentioning earlier regarding states with legislation or executive orders. So blue are states that are actively have legislation. The legislation varies anywhere from a direction to study automated vehicles to some states are allowing free testing and operation of any vehicle. So there's a wide range of legislation out there right now. And the green states are ones that have executive orders. And there's a wide range of those executive orders, too, on what they actually do, from forming committees to actually directing the testing and deployment.
Mr. Hippas, just a quick question. I think the governor just created an executive order for this, too. So will we be turning into one of the blue states now?
Yes, we will. Okay. Yep.
Continue on.
Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that leads into the next piece, is the overview of the executive order. There were basically four pillars the governor wanted to emphasize with the executive order. Is safety. He really thinks that not only is it going to help us reach our goal of towards zero death, but it's also going to improve the health of our transportation system. Some things that are done around the country, for example, Columbus, Ohio is spending an enormous amount of time and effort figuring how they can use it to help people get to health facilities faster that don't have means of transportation right now. He also saw business as the second pillar, that we can help grow our economy here in Minnesota through additional opportunities or making sure infrastructure is ready to support these vehicles. Transportation, and finally, equity. There's a lot of opportunities to make sure that these vehicles can provide that gap between the low income and the disabled to have those additional transportation options. Now, just to give you an overview of what the expected outcomes of the Advisory Council are, so the Council itself, their main tasks are to study, assess, and prepare for the transformation and opportunities associated with connected autonomous vehicles, recommend changes in state law, and submit a report to the legislature by December 1st, 2018. Those are the main tasks of the Advisory Council. What that report to the legislature would include would be recommendations on transportation infrastructure and networks, cybersecurity and data privacy, vehicle registration, training, licensing, insurance, and traffic regulations, economic development, business opportunities, and workforce preparation, and accessibility and equity for all Minnesotans. These will be the core contents of that report. So the advisory committee is made up of 15 members and ex officio offices and members. So the chairs are Commissioner Charlie Zelli from MnDOT and Christopher Clark, who is the president of Xcel Energy for the Dakotas and Minnesota. It was very important to the governor to have public-private entities both represented in the advisory council. And Xcel Energy and energy itself is a great connection with how the vehicles may actually operate in infrastructure and in networks. The advisory council will be made up of representatives from finance, transit, higher education, workforce training, insurance, public safety, local government, labor, freight, advocacy, and the automotive industry. There also are the ex officio offices, which are the state agencies of MnDOT, represented by Commissioner Zelli, agriculture, commerce, deed, health, IRRB, MNIT, public safety, and revenue. It also includes the Metropolitan Council, the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, the ranking and minority member from the Senate, and a ranking majority and minority member from the House of Representatives. In addition, the executive order also prepares Minnesota for connected and autonomous vehicles. In it, it talks about MnDOT, Department of Public Safety, and other agencies moving forward with establishing programs for development, testing, and deployment. A big piece of this, too, is also safe deployment. So if we do have an opportunity to do a demonstration or a deployment, we want to work with the other agencies to make sure that it is safe and we have a high public confidence going into those demonstrations. And very importantly, to protect all data generated would fall underneath our Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. In addition, it also forms an interagency CAV team. I apologize if I'm using that term a lot. CAV is connected on automated vehicles. This is a group led by MnDOT, and this group basically is that group that we had before with Department of Public Safety and State Patrol. We just now expanded it to include those other agencies that have an interest in it. So that group is called the Minnesota ICAV team, and we will be working together to make sure that we're coordinating among our different agencies. This cuts across many different agencies when you talk about insurance and safety and regulation and economic development. To make sure that we're coordinating on what's happening here in Minnesota and to support that advisory committee with recommendations and strategies for moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives of the committee.
Thank you for presentation, Mr. Hippis. Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question. Well, I actually have three things, and maybe they don't need to be answered now because we're going to learn more about these things in the future. One of the things is the outcomes that you wanted to bring forward on page 17. It talks about economic development, business opportunities, and workforce preparation. I'm just wondering, does MnDOT, is there any value, or could you add it to the scope to look at economic development in a broader scope, to look at economic prosperity for Minnesotans? Sometimes we have it centric on the business end of it, but people having access to jobs and those sorts of things, and there's job shortages. Coming from a person, a Minnesotan's perspective, who's not a business owner, there's a lot of value in coming up with information about that as well. So that's something, I don't know if you can answer that now or just...
Mr. Hippis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, I believe that it's in the governor's vision when he talks about workforce preparation. It's not just preparing the businesses, but our workforce, and reducing that any equity gaps that may occur. So I think that will be considered by the advisory council as they move forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just two things that popped out at me. I wrote this down, but I did see it at the end about cybersecurity. That is an issue that I'm definitely concerned about, and I'm sure that will be explored more, so you don't really have to answer that. And then the thing I was concerned about yesterday when I saw that in the mall, it was on a sidewalk, which made sense for our tour yesterday, but then when I saw you talked about these carts being on sidewalks, I mean, it's like our infrastructure right now that's being built that's going to last for 50 to 100 years is going to impact whether that's even possible, because right now our trails and our sidewalks aren't even really meeting ADA needs a lot of times or multimodal transportation on them. So I just am really concerned about the infrastructure we're building now is very minimal, and yet we're seeing that there possibly could be the need for other types of motorized transportation on those things. Could you just comment to that briefly?
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, MnDOT is actually also at the same time putting together a connected and automated strategic plan. And one of the things we're looking at is our infrastructure. We recognize that some of our long-term investments right now, we may need to take a look at they can accommodate these technologies in the future. So we're looking at what are some of the things that we should be investing in now to accommodate these potential transformational technologies, or some things that we should stop doing now that can both accommodate what's happening with our current non-autonomous vehicles and pedestrians and bikes, but yet still be prepared for the future. It's a tough question to answer right now because there's so many unknowns and so many uncertainties, but we're going to try to start making some of those strategic investments in the very near future.
Representative Salk.
My question, thank you, Mr. Chair, is kind of in regards to the issue of merger and phasing of regulation. And I think you probably mentioned that there is a start at doing it, so you may not yet have an answer, but I was thinking, are there elements of regulation that can be brought on quicker so that development can have a sense that regulation will be accommodating and or welcoming as it were to move into a market?
Mr. Hippis?
Mr. Chair, representative of the committee, the biggest thing is to make sure it's safety. Safety would be the number one concern, that we don't want to maybe push too fast and have open regulations. There is a risk of how these vehicles would operate in a snow environment, but there's probably some opportunities that we'll be looking at through the advisory council and our teams of what can we do to make sure that we have regulations that would invite some early deployments or some of those technologies as they're being developed. So that's one of the main tasks of the advisory council is how can we help foster this through regulation but not hinder it. Hopefully that addresses your question.
I think we have time for one more question from Representative Miller, but while we're doing that, if Dr. Dumner would like to start preparing, that'd be great. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hepis, there may not be the time now, but my area of interest is how the liabilities and how the insurance industry will be reflected in this. So either if you can address it briefly here or if there's something that we can talk about that, because it sounds like we're going to be talking about that more this session.
We will certainly. Insurance is going to be a big deal.
One of those challenges that I'm curious to know how we're going to address that, or how you anticipate that's going to be addressed.
Yep.
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, representative of the committee, we've have many conversations with the Department of Commerce already about insurance regulation. I've also was working on a national scale about a week or so ago with some insurance regulators and some manufacturers. One of the biggest challenges the insurance regulations have are we don't have any data on automated vehicles. So they know exactly what the risk is of a 16-year-old male in an urban environment for setting an insurance rate, but they don't know what the risk is for an automated vehicle. So that's one of the challenges that the industry is going to have. The automobile manufacturer just recommended that we don't go overboard and set limits that are kind of higher that are prescribed in law right now so we don't hinder those innovations. But this is a major topic that will be addressed through that advisory council for the recommendations. But it is being talked about here locally and on a national scale. It's a big question.
Then, Representative Howell, did you have a quick question? No? Representative Rosenthal, did you have a quick question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hibbs, you gave the example of a car with no steering wheel or pedals, and this is sort of getting back to cybersecurity and technology failure. We know that technology in cars is very advanced now, but they still fail at quite a high rate. And is there any way to override a car that does not have a steering wheel or brakes in a runaway situation?
Mr. Hippis?
Yep. Mr. Chair, representative of the committee. The vehicle that we had actually still has an operator on board, so they're not physically driving, but they're monitoring it, much like an airline pilot, the plane's on autopilot. There's still somebody that is there monitoring the systems. The one that we had an emergency stop. You could hit a button, and it was a kill switch. What the industry, this is a big risk for the industry. So when they're developing their systems, they're adding a lot of redundancy. So if one system fails, there's multiple systems that can back it up to take its place. But we'll need to work closely with the industry to make sure that there is a failure across all pieces that vehicle is able to safely slow down and be out of the way of other vehicles.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And if people have additional questions, please forward them off to Mr. Marble here, and he will pass them on to the department as well. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to the 3M presentation. And Dr. Dubner, if you could introduce yourself, who you represent, and continue on with your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Dubner, and I am the leader of the 3M Connected Roads program within 3M Company. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For nearly 80 years, 3M has advanced its mission to improve road safety and mobility. We've done that around the world with a dedicated team that's focused on bringing families home safely. 3M is a primary provider of roadway infrastructure materials, things like road signs, pavement markings, vehicle conspicuity, temporary traffic control materials, as well as license plates. And these materials improve the safety on Minnesota roadways by increasing the visibility for the motoring public. As we drive towards, as Jay described, connected and automated vehicles, and towards zero roadway fatalities, this will require an infrastructure that's now not only able to communicate to human beings, but also able to communicate to these machines that are driving on the roadways. Due to 3M's historical involvement in the safety in roadways, we believe we're uniquely positioned to bring new advancements and new innovation to that area. If you think about it, we're on a continuing journey here from the human drivers and the human-driven vehicles of yesterday to the assisted vehicles that we have today, to a future of connected and automated vehicles. We'll have a mixture of human-driven vehicles and more automated systems on the roadway for many, many years to come. Since the invention of the automobile, human beings have sat between the roadway infrastructure and the vehicle itself. They've cooperated, they've been a system, but the human being has always been involved. Now, as we think about connected and automated vehicles, we're going to have to think about a slightly different kind of system. And we're going to have to innovate to enable that system to work reliably and consistently. I thank Jay Hyptis for bringing this slide to the fore. And it is important to recognize that we will see a combination of technologies on these vehicles. We'll see automated systems, sensors, cameras, radar, and we'll also see communication systems like radios and other telecommunications devices. All of these things will be layered together as sort of a system of systems that will enable redundancy and simplicity and ultimately safety of these vehicles as they navigate the roadways. But it's going to be a pretty complex environment that these vehicles are going to operate in. In fact, in this photo, it's pretty challenging even for a human being to identify the no left turn sign. So safety depends on simplicity and redundant systems and properly designed infrastructure with appropriate technologies that can provide consistent, reliable data that enables safe operation. So I have a few examples. The first example is pavement markings. They're a very convenient navigational marker, and they're used today in some of the level 1 and level 2 vehicles that are on the roadways. However, they can present challenges for these sensors in the same way that they can present challenges for human beings. If the pavement markings are poor or worn, they can be difficult to detect. If they disappear at night or in the rain, that can be a challenge. Glare in the morning or in the evening can also present challenges for these systems. And last but not least, if there are cracks or seals in the roadway, those can be mistakenly identified as pavement markings. So 3M has been working on technology, and I'll show you a video here in a moment, that can help to resolve some of those issues, and we continue to work on technologies that improve the overall conditions. So we've all been in the situation of driving on the road in the rain, and all of a sudden, the pavement markings disappear. That's an unsafe condition and something that we do not want to have happen for humans or machines. So here's a vehicle driving in the rain at night, and there are pavement markings there, but they're barely visible. With technology that 3M has developed, wet retroreflectivity that allows the pavement markings to be visible is now possible. In this last segment, you can see side by side the same section of roadway with a different pavement marking on it, and you can see those pavement markings. So there are opportunities to improve the infrastructure to allow vehicles and humans, for that matter, to navigate more safely on the roads. The system should be designed to enable simple, reliable performance. And here's a second example where we're using an infrastructure technology that simplifies detection, classification, and interpretation of the sign. And we're taking advantage of the optical characteristics of roadway signs and their performance in infrared light. In this first segment, in the daytime, you can see that left turn lane sign come by. It's pretty fast. In IR light, it's much more easily detectable. Side by side, you can see that the IR is a much easier for a human and a machine. The next step, of course, is then once you detect the sign, you have to classify it and you have to interpret what it means. And while machine intelligence is improving all the time, it's currently not capable of substituting for a human being. And in this example, errors like the one shown at the bottom, where the machine misclassifies this stop sign with a few augmentations to it as a speed limit sign, that's an unacceptable failure. So we need to simplify and create more robust solutions for human beings and for machines. And 3M has been working on a technology that not only enables human-readable signs, but also embedded smart codes that can be read by IR cameras on these connected and automated vehicles. This approach enables reliability because it provides the machine the information in a form that the machine is very familiar with. It's machine language. It also can enable additional information such as location and other things that can support the operation of the vehicle. Similar technology can be used in work zones on temporary traffic control materials. And this, layered with other technologies such as mapping, can help enable the safe navigation of work zones for humans and machines. We've tested this technology outside of Detroit on I-75 using construction work zone signs where we could detect and classify these signs at highway speeds. On the left-hand side is an image of the sign. Looks like a normal human-readable retroreflective sign on the side of the roadway. And the screen on the right shows several different images from a few different sources. In the bottom right-hand corner of that computer screen is the visible camera image. That's what a camera mounted on the front of the vehicle is seeing as it drives down the roadway in visible light. On the upper right-hand corner, that's what the camera that's an IR camera sees. And on the left-hand side is how the vehicle is interpreting that information as it goes by. This is a video on a moving vehicle of that installation. This is a video in the daytime. You can see the signs come by. They're quickly interpreted, what the sign says, where the sign is located, even in some cases additional information. And then the sign and the information can persist for several seconds after the sign has passed. Same thing, in fact, the same corridor, now in nighttime, so even the lights of the traffic don't interfere with the camera's ability to detect the sign, classify the sign, and then interpret what's on it as it reads that embedded barcode. The human being is still able to see that sign as they're driving down the road. Mr. Chairman, as government stakeholders prepare for the future of automated transportation, a holistic strategy that includes changes to both vehicle and road infrastructure is required. Roadway safety devices such as pavement markings and road signs, temporary traffic control devices, should all be designed to not only enable the safe operation of these connected and automated vehicles, but also to enable and maintain the safety standards that have been set for human beings. In order to achieve uniformity, appropriate standards for these roadway safety devices must be developed. And connected and automated vehicles must operate in harmony with the infrastructure in order to achieve high safety standards that the public demands. National, state, and local governments will play a critical role in whether the benefits that we envision for these connected and automated transportation systems can actually be realized. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Dubner, and I also have been to the 3M and gone through a couple of your presentations there, showing how the signs are being read through various images that the human eye can't see, but the camera can, and it's very fascinating how that happens. We do have time for one or two questions. I believe Representative Howell has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess, you know, I understand that this is going to have to be a national push, because otherwise some of these what your car does in one state and what it's capable of and what that vehicle's capable of in another state will directly depend upon these signs and this technology that we're looking at. What is the cost difference between an intelligent sign like we looked at and the old sign that has none of that technology embedded in it? What's the increase in cost of that technology to put that sign up? Because I could envision there's the local governments that are required to put those signs up. That's going to be quite an increase, I would anticipate, in the cost of maintaining that infrastructure.
Dr. Dubner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Howe. I appreciate the question. It's something we think about a lot, because our customers are those road custodians all around the world at the national, state, and local level. We want to develop systems that not only enable safety, but are also effective and cost-effective for those stakeholders. And we see that there are opportunities to not make these signs prohibitively expensive and decrease the adoption of these kinds of technologies for connected and automated vehicles. There are a variety of different ways that we're considering doing that, but I would like you to rest assured that we're thinking about how to help the municipalities that need to pay for these, how to do that in an effective, cost-effective way.
Representative Holland, follow-up?
Just one, very quick. And I know that with all the construction that, you know, we got two seasons, winter and construction. And when construction comes on, we have all these temporary sign companies that come out. That's quite an outlay of dollars that they're going to look at to put all those temporary signs out that are going to have to be upgraded to this new technology. So it'll be interesting to see how we move forward. Thank you.
Representative Sandin.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Just to follow up on the previous question, when I was a kid, you'd see vandalism on some of these signs, printing, that type of thing. It could obscure the sign. I'm just wondering, with the technological proficiency of some of the young people, could they be actually alter some of these codes and throw a sticker on one of those signs and misdirect traffic one way or another? What's preventing the modern-day vandal from doing such a thing?
Dr.
It will
Gunner?
Happen.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin. 3M has had a long history in understanding how people try to mutate systems on the roadways and in other places. And we are anticipating the kinds of attacks that you're talking about. Mr. Hiptis talked about layers of technology that enable redundancy to ensure that hacking one system doesn't necessarily thwart the entire system. And that's part of the formulation that we'll use here. I don't want to tell you that nobody can ever hack a sign. We're putting technology in there that we think will make it exceptionally difficult. However, if someone is successful, we envision a system that will have fail-safes and redundancy that will allow the vehicle to continue to maintain a safe navigation down the roadway.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that end, are you thinking or is there a pathway by which you could give a local jurisdiction a sticker so they could merge over using old stock, maybe updated in some temporary fashion so that then they can kind of mitigate their front cost and get additional use out of their inventory that they have?
Dr. Dubner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Salk, I think you should come join 3M. That's something we have thought about, to be able to retrofit signs with these embedded codes.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Dubner. Obviously, 3M is a wonderful company, and we want to see you succeed. But I'm concerned about competition from other companies and how that interaction will work. And car dealers and car manufacturers, you know, there's going to be competition, I would think, between these different technologies and how they will interact with each other.
Dr. Dubner, do you have a follow-up or a comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenthal, I believe in the free market and those forces, and I believe that in the effort of public safety and other things that these companies will find ways to cooperate. It's already happening.
Representative Bernardi, I'm going to give you the last question from this testifier.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I had was regarding subcontractors you use and things like that. I'm assuming you contract out some work or have subcontractors and work you do. Have you thought about the security issues with that, and would it be reserved for U.S. companies, or what is your thinking on that subject?
Dr. Dubner?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, I'm not entirely sure I know what your question is.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about security, and so when you do business, I'm guessing you do business collaboratively with other people besides just employees of 3M, have you thought about how you would do business with people that you collaborate that might would they all have to be within the U.S. for security reasons, or could they be from around the world? We have a global economy.
Dr. Dubner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, 3M deals with that kind of an issue all the time with respect to other parts of our business and intellectual property and protecting 3M's intellectual property and, in some cases, protecting particular jurisdictions or even countries. And so we have thought through those kinds of issues. As this technology evolves, if we see that there are needs to protect some of the security and perhaps fence off some of the access to the information, we are easily able to do that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dubner, for your presentation. And I remind everybody that if you do have any further questions, please contact Mr. Marble with those, and we will get answers to them. We will next hear from the Minnesota Trucking Association. And while they're setting up, I do now officially call, we do have a quorum, so I do officially call this meeting to order. And we do have some minutes of March 6th in front of us. And Representative Daniels, would you like to move those minutes?
I so move.
The motion has been made to approve the minutes of March 6th. Is there any discussion or correction? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And so we have a few testifiers from the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I'm assuming they're going to be talking about platooning and some of the other things that we've heard previously. And as soon as they get their IT equipment working, we will move forward. Do you want to get started now? That'd be great. Please introduce yourself for the committee and who you represent.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent Boyce. I'm president and owner of Calhoun Truck Lines based in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I am also chairman of the Automated Vehicle Task Force for the Minnesota Trucking Association. I believe it's important to stress at the outset that there is, and will be in the future, a high demand for professional truck drivers. We believe the professional truck driver will remain in the cab, but the role will evolve as automated technology assists with certain driving tasks. In some situations, the professional truck driver of the future may operate more like an airline pilot, handling city driving and using automation to assist in the middle of the run. I believe driver assist technology will generate numerous benefits in the area of safety, environment, productivity, efficiency, and driver health and wellness. I'm also excited about how emerging driver assist technology holds promise to attract new, digitally savvy women and men to the truck driving profession. The Minnesota Trucking Association believes the state of Minnesota should enact policies that enhance safety, foster creativity, and enable uniform adoption of driver assist technology. That includes passing legislation that opens up Minnesota for driver assist technology testing. This afternoon, I am pleased to have with me today a key player in trucking technology world, Mr. Steve Boyd of Peloton. He will provide an overview of driver assist technology available now and in the near future for commercial trucks.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and continue.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Brent, and pleasure to be here today. Chairman Petersburg and members of the committee, thank you very much. Great to be here in Minnesota, particularly during the amazing state championship hockey tournament. Hockey championship underway right now. I'm hoping to catch some games here later today. I may change my schedule completely. So thank you for taking time away from those games to be here. So we're excited about our work with Minnesota Trucking Association, with Brent and his colleagues, and with Minnesota DOT and Highway Patrol on our work on these things. We're members of the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance, and it's good to see some friends from the Minnesota Highway Patrol here who are part of the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance and who we've spoken to in the past as part of that work.
Please, for the minutes, introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm sorry. Jump right into it. So my name is Steve Boyd, and I'm co-founder and vice president of external affairs of Peloton Technology, and we're glad here to be today. I'd like to say that our focus in working with the DOT and the Highway Patrol and the fleets here in this region is about safety, efficiency, and driver assistance. Our company is focused on efficiency, safety, and driver teamwork improvement in freight trucking. And I'll run through some slides here, and then we'll be able to turn to some questions. The focus here will look at an overview of where things exist with this type of technology, our system, and then the sort of picture of what's happening in other states. Our system involves, and driver-assisted truck platooning in general, is a system that involves teamwork by drivers. It's not self-driving trucks. It's not high automation. It's exactly the driver-assist type technologies that were referred to by the previous speakers and by Brent. So our trucks require the best available safety systems on each truck. This includes state-of-the-art collision avoidance, disc brakes on all tractor axles, lane departure warning, and then additional connectivity information that improves the driver's awareness of the road. And that serves these trucks to be safer individually everywhere they go, whether or not they're in platoon. So as part of this, our system uses connectivity between the vehicles to provide direct driver-to-driver communications on a dedicated channel, so these drivers are able to communicate and work together in a new way on the road, enhanced by having safety systems connected between those trucks. The trucks have their active safety systems, look-ahead radar, and object recognition video connected so that the follow truck is able to benefit from the front truck looking ahead at the road ahead, and the drivers work together as well. So you have the double layer of active safety systems that brake the truck to a stop if there's an obstacle that arises, as well as the drivers there working in the loop and being best informed. We also limit platooning to just two trucks, not longer chains of trucks. And this is only being done within the same fleets and with new trucks. So this is not something that's going to be deployed on hundreds of old trucks, and it's not going to be occurring between multiple fleets together, at least in the initial phase. First phase of all this is between trucks of the same fleet. We're working with just the major fleets on this initially. That's the way these kind of technologies are brought out traditionally. And our partners include all of the major truck OEMs. So everything we do has to be backed fully by them, full safety validation process, warranty backed by these OEMs. And that is a major and challenging gate for any of these technologies. So as a result of that, you can't have rogue players coming in to this space and developing platooning systems and rolling them out to fleets. That's not possible. It has to go through the big OEMs. There's, you know, five or six of them here in the U.S. They're not going to deploy anything into the industry that doesn't meet their rigorous existing and robust safety approaches for these kind of systems. And same way with the fleets, they're not going to use anything that doesn't meet those standards. So there's already industry-driven approaches that prevent misuse of these kind of technologies, and we're excited about now moving towards deployment in a number of states. There's 10 states now that have approved full commercial deployment of truck platooning, and we're excited to talk to Minnesota about how they may become part of that picture. A big factor, certainly was mentioned earlier, is certainly weather and construction in many parts of the northern part of the U.S. And our system actively limits use of the system to only appropriate roads, multi-lane divided limited access highways, and under appropriate weather and traffic conditions. The driver can't make a mistake on misusing it, because we're going to be preventing the use of it outside of appropriate conditions. So moving on to the next slide here. The picture globally is that all six manufacturers in Europe have truck platooning systems and have already demonstrated them over the last couple of years. In the U.S., all of the other truck OEMs here also have systems in varying degrees of progress. Ourselves and Freightliner, which is Daimler Trucks North America, are the two coming to market first. Both of us have two truck systems, driver-assisted, not high automation, not self-driving. These are some of the brands globally that are involved with this. It's the full space, the full set of industry, both here in the U.S. Many of these companies active here in Minnesota and involve Minnesota jobs, and also globally. And we're going to go here to a video. And let's see how well this plays. I may need some technical assistance here. Here we go.
How's Emma doing?
She misses you.
I know. I'll be home soon.
Proceed at 54 miles per hour. How's it going up front?
They're clearing up a jam in Grand Junction, but it should be good by the time we get there. How's it going back there?
We got a Challenger coming up on us real fast.
Cutting, detected.
All right, the Challenger's exiting now.
Tempora, where are you headed?
I'm going home. It's my daughter's first birthday.
Before you know it, she'll be running. I'm going to stop for fuel up ahead.
Sounds good. I'm going to keep going.
Stay safe out there.
Thanks, I will.
Great. So as you can see there, it's a driver teamwork system. The drivers remain in full command of their vehicles at all times, and they're communicating at all times about the work of the on the road there. The systems provide safety on the individual truck at all times and connected safety between the trucks. You can also see that, notably, the system provides a view of the road ahead for the driver in the following position. So it's a window through that truck. And obviously, when we're all driving, one of the biggest blind spots we face are the vehicles in front of us. We open that up, something that really changes the net safety on the road today, where trucks are often stacked up together, manually driven, without safety systems, and without that kind of additional view and this teamwork. So this slide shows kind of the full picture summarized of vehicle-to-vehicle connectivity between these trucks, shared safety, and the additional layer, which I mentioned, is that oversight of the trucks. So using cloud-based management, we're monitoring these trucks and making sure that they're only used in the appropriate roadways and environments. Many of the automakers that have been developing automated, near automated systems or driver assist solutions have found that they need to do this as well. So they've geofenced to, say, prevent their car systems from being used in the wrong kinds of roads. That Tesla incident that was a couple years back now, that driver was using that on an inappropriate road. Since that time, Tesla and other companies have put some limits on where you can use that system. Now, in our solution, of course, we're not automated, but we're also managing then where do you use this driver assist solution appropriately. We think that's the right, robust way that the industry needs to handle these kinds of solutions. So the way we get to closer following distance is that we're eliminating the perception and reaction time that you normally need. A professional driver often needs 2 seconds or more to perceive and then react to something changing in front of them. Using this advanced safety system looking ahead, we're able to handle the perception and the reaction, eliminating that necessary headway that you normally have to allow. We also eliminate brake lag. Obviously, Class A trucks have air brakes, and there's a lag after you engage the brakes. We eliminate that because the connectedness provides an instantaneous connection so that as soon as the front truck is sensing and reacting, the back truck has begun slowing already. So this is the ability to get that closer following as a result of those changes to the way trucks normally operate. So our approach, again, drivers fully engaged in vehicles at all times, both vehicles at all times. They're driving the whole time. They're steering at all times. So we're only managing the forward motion of the trucks. The steering is always engaged by the drivers. We'll be glad to provide the committee with some additional videos that show the system in use. Obviously, that video had it was more of a marketing-type video, but we have videos showing our trucks in operation today, including 1,200 miles we just ran in Florida under the direct supervision of the Florida Highway Patrol, Florida DOT, where they were monitoring and understanding more about the system. We have a video we'll send to you that shows the view from the driver's position and back as the driver remains in command of the vehicle and coordinates and works in a teamwork fashion with the driver ahead, and how this allows them to change lanes when they need to and overtaking and passing. But generally speaking, these trucks are operating just as trucks do today, operating in the left lane or whatever lane they're supposed to be in on a given roadway, and working together in a fashion that's better than trucks stacked up today without safety, without connectivity. So foundationally, our approach is to improve that safety on all trucks, raise the safety spec on every truck. Almost no trucks today have disc brakes on all four axles, on all axles, whatever number they have, and in the case of given configurations. And no trucks have, almost no trucks have these advanced safety systems. We're trying to raise the spec on all these trucks to a higher standard and help the industry to be safer as a whole. The other thing we mentioned is this control of use of the system in the right environments. And I'd love to take any questions you have about that, but that's a core part of our approach. And the focus, again, is improving efficiency, reducing cost of deploying safety systems into fleets. And let me move ahead here to the last thing as we run out of time here. I think nationally, we have a situation where 10 states have now approved full commercial deployment of truck platooning. And the green pictured states here are those that have already done so. Orange states represent those where they're testing and are moving towards deployment approval. For example, Utah has now passed and the bill is going to the governor allowing full commercial deployment. The same is true for a number of the other states there. A number of other states in this region are moving right now to act on this. For example, Wisconsin now has a bill going to the governor approving full commercial deployment. Indiana has a bill on a good track right now, and likewise some of the other states, Kentucky, Missouri, and others. So right here in the region, in the Great Lakes, in the central region of the country, in the Midwest, we have a lot of progress in this technology, and our partners regionally include companies based in the region like Navistar and others. So with that, I'll wrap up and look forward to your questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you again for your testimony from both of you. We really appreciate it. I have one question while the Alliance for Automobile Manufacturers are setting up. We could probably take one quick question from Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a bit about the channel that the vehicles are communicating on? For instance, is that channel then available or open to law enforcement? Because I could just see a platoon of six trucks or three or two in your current case going down the road and appearing to be driving recklessly in that they are extraordinarily close relative to the normal standard of traffic. So is there some way that the law enforcement people will know these are controlled conditions that are enhanced because of the technology?
Yes, there's a couple
Mr.
ways.
Boy, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the good question. The couple approaches we use to identifying the vehicles for the purpose of law enforcement. The initial deployments of these trucks, first of all, it's not large numbers of trucks. It's going to be small numbers working with some of the major fleets. So our approach is to, and this is now in place in states like Michigan and Ohio, also who've approved commercial deployment, we provide a list to the DOT and DPS, or Highway Patrol, of the equipped fleets, which starts out with a small number, and then the list of the VIN numbers of the trucks that are equipped with the system and the routes they're running on, and rough times of day of operation. So there's an awareness of where the systems are, where they're going to be operating, which fleets, which of course are distinctively branded. In addition, we are working with the fleets to, and the OEMs to do a marking system that's on either side of the tractor that identifies it as a platooning equipped truck. Now we're just a collaborator, of course, with working with the OEMs and the fleets. So we don't suppose to impose a markings approach that they don't agree with. So there's a dialogue with them now about the markings that make sense, and we're in a very early phase of moving this out. But that marking is something that's been approved, and that approach has been approved by a number of the highway patrols in other states, along with the notification of the lists of fleets and the equipped trucks.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate that, and we will be looking forward to more information later. We are now on to the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, I should say. Again, if you have additional questions for the Trucking Association, please let Joe Marble know, and he will get that information to you. Mr. Yates, please introduce yourself and who you represent for the committee and continue on with the presentation. Thank you for being here.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Leighton Yates. I'm the Senior Manager of Government Affairs for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Today I'm here to speak to you about the auto industry's perspective on autonomous vehicles and where we see them going. For those of you that are not familiar with the Alliance, we're a trade association that represents 12 of the world's leading car manufacturers. Together they represent 70% of the cars and light-duty trucks sold in the U.S. each year. Today what I'm going to get down to is to answer some of the questions around AVs, the hows, the whys, the wheres, what's and when's. So first we'll get into the how did we get here. When I think of AVs, first things that come to mind are the future, the Jetsons, sitting in my car with my wife on a road trip when we can watch a movie, have a conversation, and have a bite to eat at the same time. Believe it or not, 50 years ago, folks were having these same sorts of conversations. The clip here on this slide is a clip from a popular science magazine from 1958. And you'll see they mentioned some of the same things that I was talking about, playing a game with their family in the car while the car's on the road, or having a meal, or, if you smoke cigarettes, you can give your loved one love eyes and light their cigarettes while you're in the car and not have to steer anything. So these ideas aren't new, and to see them actually come to fruition on the roads and coming soon is very exciting, not only to myself, but also to our members. We're spending a lot of time and money making sure these things are safe and on the road in a timely manner. So when you think about cars now, many people have described them as a computer on wheels, but that would be a wrong classification. It's really multiple computers on wheels. Cars now, they have anywhere from 60 to 100 sensors, all doing 100 to 60 different jobs. And in the future, where we see these cars going with more sensors and automation, they could have upwards of 200 sensors on any given car. And when I talk about these sensors, what am I talking about? What are these technologies? This diagram kind of gives you an example of some of the features that you actually may have on your car now, the lane change assistance, blind spot detection. Some of these cars, they can parallel park themselves. The front and rear view mirrors, those cameras, those are the type of technologies we're talking about. And together, they make up the system, which is the automated driving system. And those features, those are the eyes and ears of the cars. The previous gentleman mentioned in trucking, it's a two-second reaction time. These systems will be able to react faster than the fastest human with the fastest reactions on the planet and do it in an effective manner. And the ways they're doing it is through multiple types of technology, radar, lane-keeping cameras, LIDAR. You might be wondering what LIDAR is. If you've ever seen a test vehicle, most of them have a little spinning cylinder on top, and that's the LIDAR sensor, which essentially gives the car a 360 digital view of what's happening around it. What is that, a tree? Is that a building? Is that a car? Is that a bike? Is that a dog? Am I staying in the lane? Those type of things. And you get down to the light cameras, GPS, which will be very important with mapping, not just for passenger cars, but commercial applications as well as wheel-mounted sensors. But the real answer to how we got here is the money. You can always follow the money to find out what someone's intentions are. Just to put it into perspective, the aerospace industry and defense globally in 2015 spent $21 billion, which is a lot of money. But in that same year, automakers spent over $100 billion on R&D for automated technology. So you can tell that's where the membership is going. The other big issue is electrification of vehicles, which is also, the number is actually pretty close to this $104.7 billion number. And many believe that in the next 10 years, our industry will change more than it has in the last 50 years, all the way back to that 1958 magazine clip that I showed you earlier. But the bigger question is why did we come here? There's many reasons, safety, environmental, land use, road use, but the real crux of it is safety. Our members are building these cars because, as you all know, there are too many fatalities on U.S. roads today, and the number is already increasing year by year. And it's pretty unique because, as you see here from 2015, 1.25 million people died on roads globally. 35,000 and change happened here in the U.S., but the number keeps going up. This graph here shows vehicles mile traveled on top of deaths over the years, as well as the fatality rates, and cars undeniably have gotten more safe as the years have gone by. But different factors of whether it's the economy or political, you know, whether it's war or gas prices, it makes people drive more or less. And as more people drive, unfortunately, that's more instances where folks are getting in accidents, and some of those are fatal, to the point where in 2016 the number got up to 37,491. And that is a staggering number, but it's up 5.6% from the previous year. So the goal of autonomous vehicles and automated technology is to get that number down to as close to zero as possible year over year. Going on to the benefits, environmental. These cars are expected to be able to travel closer, similar to how the platooning technology works, via communication and sensors. And when that congestion goes down, it makes fuel efficiency go up. You don't have to speed up on your gas, hit at your brake. There also isn't the angry driver who's speeding around everyone, cutting through lanes. Everyone should be in a perfect autonomous world, in sync, and flowing evenly and together. I mean, with that comes less emissions, which helps everyone in the environment as well. Next is infrastructure. As these cars, as I mentioned, traveling closer and more succinctly, you're able to use more of your roads, and that could be used for public transit. It could be used to integrate public transit. I know the Super Bowl shuttle here was an example of a transit opportunity for automated technology, and many states and cities have seen that trend. There's airport shuttle pilots happening now across the country, as well as bus pilots as well. One that hits close to home for me is mobility. My grandmother, she's hits 90 in 2 months, and she lives in a retirement community, and, you know, she's happy and lively, but she is pretty limited to where she can go, whether it's the new restaurant in downtown Jacksonville or even, you know, something as simple to the beach, and she lives in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. This technology is expected to be able to give not only the elderly but the disabled as well the freedom to move about their communities and really be a part of their community and feel like they're able to experience the same things that you and I are able to, who can drive ourselves or even, you know, walk down the road. One area that some folks don't really think of is land use. Some cities have shown that autonomous cars will be able to park as close as 4 inches on each side of each other. I know now some very capable humans need about 5 feet of clearance on each side to not hit the car next to them. So the fact that they'll be able to park so much closer will tell you. Excuse me?
You don't have to open the door.
Well, in a parking garage setting, essentially your car would park itself. You would pull up to the parking garage, it would go to its spot, and you could go about, and once you're back, it'll come back to you. And that's just one scenario, but you'll be able to have greater land use for not only your outdoor parking lots, but your stacked parking garages as well, which could be used for either green space or more businesses or some kind of mixed development. So next is where are we going? And I have a quote here from the previous U.S. DOT Secretary, Anthony Fox. He says, we are on the cusp of a new era in automotive technology with enormous potential to save lives, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and transform mobility for the American people. And that really is a consensus across anyone involved in this industry. But what it really needs is a baseline. And in what we have now is the SAE levels of automation. SAE International, formerly just SAE, represents the automotive engineers that are working for companies like the members that I represent, as well as the tech companies and folks in the automotive space. And what they've come up with is essentially a common language for folks like myself, speaking to policymakers, as well as just the normal American citizen, to describe the types of automation. And what they've come up with is SAE levels, and it goes from 0 to 5. And as you can guess with 0, you have 0 automation in your car. You're responsible for everything in the driving task from getting point A to point B. And while you may have some help, many of you have the mirrors that will tell you if the car is passing you on your right or your left and not to change lanes. You may have features like that, but for the majority of the trip, essentially all of the trip, you're responsible for maneuvering the car and reacting and responding. As you get up to level 1, these cars have some features, but they're in a minimal aspect. Usually they'll have a technology that will help you keep your lane or adjustable cruise control that you can adjust without having to actually physically push on the steering pedal or the brake pedal. Moving on to level 2, there actually are some level 2 vehicles on the road now. GM has a Cadillac CT6 that has a very high level 2 automated driving system. But what it essentially does is it combines some of those singular features into your car, like the lane keeping and adjustable cruise control, that will augment some of the driving experience, but you are steering and pedaling and changing lanes and so on and so forth. When we get to level 3, this is when we were talking about the autonomous vehicles that everyone's talking about today. These are the high levels of automation, levels 3, 4, and 5. In level 3, the caveat here is that while the vehicle will be able to perform many aspects of the driving task in instances where it's not, whether that's weather or construction or geofence type setting where it's not permitted, the human is expected to take over in those situations, and the vehicle will have a safe manner of handing that transition over to the driver or taking it over from the driver. Level 4 is most likely the largest capacity of AVs that we will see. You've heard some of the previous speakers mention about it, but usually what we expect to see is campuses or transit-type projects in Level 4 where you don't necessarily need a steering wheel or a brake pedal, but these cars won't be on the highways and widespread across cities. They'll be usually geofenced or curfewed and have some limitations to them, but they will be able to get you from point A to point B without you having to control the vehicle. And level 5 is the holy grail of automation. It's what everyone talks about when they say driverless cars, and it should be a true driverless car where you can program it from point A to point B and it does everything for you, whether it's change lanes, slow down, communicate back to you, whether that's for entertainment purposes or for road purposes. And this is not expected to have any sort of restrictions. And the biggest question I get on the road for these is when are they coming? And unfortunately, that is not an easy question, and it does not have an easy answer. Really, what it comes down to is the timing. The timing is tough to predict because it's such a competitive space. Some of our members are a part of development relating to Level 3 vehicles. Some are going straight to Level 4. So it's a little bit staggered, but Ford has announced for 2021 to have a vehicle. VW in 2019 will have a Level 3 vehicle. GM has announced a Level 4 vehicle as soon as next year, with many more manufacturers behind it. And this is my mention of Level 4 as far as where we can expect to see them, and those are the closed campuses, the geofence, ride-sharing type settings. To give you somewhat of a projection, this is just from internal projections. Obviously, these cars aren't being sold yet or on the road or really ubiquitous across the roadways, but we expect in 2050, 30 years from now, for these cars to be very common on the roads. 40% to 60% of our nationwide fleet, we would expect to have some level of automation, and the sales will be pretty significant, if not all. So getting down, and I'll get to this pretty quickly, is the challenge for legislators. Most of these deployments will be limited and not on the road, meaning you're not going to see these on car dealership slots really anytime soon when you speak of really the high levels of automation. But there's many challenges, and that's whether it's the transition, laws that are on the books now and how they can relate to these new laws, security, as well as public education. The feds have done a few things, and the guidance that was mentioned earlier is one of them, and what it really does is give the states a clear delineation of who's responsible for what. The NHTSA and DOT is responsible for how the car is built, the design, the performance, and states should really stick to their traditional roles of insurance, licensing, registration, as well as law enforcement. There's also federal legislation pending now that will likely affect all 50 states and have some preemption provisions to it, and that's something that we expect to happen as early as the summer. But where to start? Some suggestions we have are to look at your current laws, to look at your infrastructure. The previous speaker from 3M did a really good job showing the importance of infrastructure and AVs, as well as convening stakeholder groups, which is achieved through the executive order from yesterday, as well as identifying a lead agency. And this, personally, for me, is what I think is really important for a state. You really need someone to be a clearinghouse for AV, whether they can speak to the lower levels of government and also disseminate that information to the higher levels. So Minnesota's off to a good start with their executive order, as well as some of the testing from the Super Bowl. And with that, and I will wrap up. I want to thank you for the opportunity, and the auto industry is here to be a resource on this issue and many more, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and appreciate your presentation as well. BSI Labs is next. Andy Kim, and please set up your communication. But we do have two quick questions. Otherwise, please present them to Joe Marble, Representative Rarick, and then Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question from the industry's viewpoint. We heard earlier some testimony about reading signs and such. Do you see that as being a big part of it in conjunction? Right now, our cell phones and cars have these mapping systems that it instantly comes up, hey, this area is 45 miles an hour, or stops coming up. Do you see that as being a big part of how they'll work rather than having to read the signs, or is it going to be?
It's an important part, but with so many sensors, there's many different stimulus they can take on, whether that's signs or GPS or light or just motion sensing. They don't necessarily need to be connected to work properly, but it will make them work better. Better signage and better lane striping will make them work better, which means they're just more easily detected, which helps those systems perform even better.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment is just to members around the table, because there is one legislator who is using autonomous vehicles in a belief that they're going to happen so fast that right now we can stop investing in public mass transit, because this is so I think this paragraph, challenge for legislators, insurance, if level 4 and 5 technologies were mandated today, it would take 25 years for 95% of the U.S. fleet to roll over. That just observation. But the question, I guess, is have you talked about what happens to the congestion on roadways when all those seniors who now can no longer drive now get back into these autonomous vehicles and we have vastly more cars on existing roadways?
Mr. Yates, do you have a crystal ball there?
I'll give you a short answer. Part of that is collaboration for multiple stakeholders, the DOT, the manufacturers, law enforcement. But two, looking forward, many of these cars are expected to have almost being a car-sharing fleet. We expect many people to have less cars and share cars, ownership of cars, and that's pretty far off. But once you get to that point, it's something that is very possible.
Well, thank you again for your testimony, and if you have further questions, please get them to Joe Marble, and he will get them on. Next, we have BSI Labs, and Danny Kim, I think, is starting the presentation. So welcome to the committee, and once you get set up, you may start with your presentation. Thank you. Please introduce yourself and who you represent.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and House Representatives. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me and BSI for this hearing. My name is Danny Kim, and I am a partner and director of BSI's Advisory Services. BSI is a technology research company specialized in autonomous driving technologies, and we are actually located in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. We do functional evaluation of building blocks of automated driving system under our lab. We are actually building our own car and testing out different components. And we provide AV industry and technology insights to our automotive OEMs and suppliers of clients. As an analyst of this automotive industry, I would like to give you more perspectives from industry and technologies and what's really happening right now in AV community, especially this extended ecosystem, automated mobility on demand, in short, AMOD. To introduce to the relatively new concept, AMOD, or robotaxi, I'll discuss on changes in personal mobility and what the main drivers of these changes are. After defining what AMOD is and who are actually deploying such services in limited environments, I'll talk about current technology gaps between where we are right now and automated mobility at scale. Finally, I'll talk about the new extended ecosystem players, who's driving the innovation and commercialization. organization called Mobility Transportation published a model that peak car ownership in the United States will occur around 2020. and will drop rapidly after that. So it's pretty soon. According to Rethink's XF report, by 2030, 95% of all U.S. passenger miles will be served by transport as a service providers at a cost up to 10 times cheaper than today's individually owned vehicles. So for consumers, transportation by automated mobility on demand is widely expected to be much cheaper than today's on-demand mobility model, which is basically Uber and Lyft model, because it's taking out the human driver and it will lower the cost for the operations. Barclay Research estimated in 2015 that shared autonomous vehicles will increase annual miles per vehicle from 12,000 to 64,000 miles, and the cost per mile to consumers will be less than 50 cents for a sedan. Under Uber's current business model, about 50 to 60% revenue stays with the car owners. But driverless vehicle would divert much of that revenue back to the service providers. So robotaxi will increase the opportunity for shared mobility by taking the human driving sector out. By pooling rides, fleets can further decrease total cost of ownership, making the service more accessible to users. Very interesting is such economic benefits are well understood by traditional automotive OEMs and their suppliers. Beyond strong consumer demand, there is a really powerful economic incentives to the early participant. Gil Pratt of Toyota Research Institute, who actually invested $3 billion in 2 years for R&Ds of automotive vehicle technologies. He basically said, myth is that billions of dollars are being spent on autonomous driving only for critical reasons, safety, congestion, accessibility, traffic, and environmental issues, but actually the reality behind their motivation is also increasing mobility as a service provider. The productivity is the major motivation. And then at CES earlier this year, Toyota introduced the e-pilot concept vehicle, reflecting one of Toyota's vision for automated mobility as a service applications. Similarly, GM's so-called plan for transportation as a service, it's actually meant to complement the automaker's core business as well. GM said current cost per mile in a city such as San Francisco is more than $3, $2.50 for the passengers. But GM expects that the cost per mile of its autonomous ride-sharing vehicles to be under $1 by 2025 by reducing the vehicle cost, including components and all software, and then improving the duty cycle and maximizing the utilization rates of AVs. So here's the definition of the AMOD as part of all mobility and service industry. What is mobility on demand? It's a transportation that can be scheduled for individual use via smartphone app, for example, whereby the user can summon the vehicle to his or her current location, basically Uber and Lyft model. And then AMOD, automated mobility on demand, is also called robotaxi or driverless taxi, and it's an autonomous car operated in mobility on-demand service. So car sharing or bike sharing services are actually under all this mobility as a service or transportation as a service, but technically not mobility on-demand. because users need to go to a certain location to consume the transportation mode as a service, not as efficient as automated mobility on demand. So Mr. Yates and other speakers talked about this SAA level. Here, the traditional automotive industry has been focusing on producing these low-level systems first on the road, and then incrementally enable higher-level systems. That's what auto industry is doing. On the other hand, public transportation industry, including those transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft, they are starting right at level 4 or immediately aiming at level 5 automation. It doesn't make sense to develop a partially automated public transportation where a human or passenger has to take over the control of the vehicle when it needs to, which is level 3. What that also means is that the public transport offers the quickest development path to full autonomy because it can start operating in a limited area. This is fundamentally different path from automotive industry, where public transport industry's focus should be different from automotive industry. Several studies highlight that robotaxi operated in AMOD model could be one of the most rapidly adopted applications of autonomous cars at scale. First, public pilot of robotaxi was done by Nutonomy, which is actually MIT spin-off, with a ride-hailing company, is Grab in Singapore, then with Lyft in Boston area. In France, Navia, autonomous cab, unveiled in November last year, has no cockpit, no steering wheel or pedals, and is capable of speeds up to 55 miles per hour. It has 10 LiDAR sensors, 6 cameras, 4 radars, a lot of sensors. It's definitely different from what you are seeing in the road as a production vehicle. Navia says current plan is to begin services in the second quarter of 2018. In the States, Waymo's, the Google company, Waymo's early rider program has been in operation in Chandler, Arizona, since last April, last year. In November, also, they announced that it makes its first commercial deployment of on-demand driverless service within Phoenix metro area. Very recently, like 20 days ago, the state of Arizona approved this commercial service. They granted a license, and Google is going to start the real consumer commercial service for the first time. This is already happening. Initially, there will be no safety driver, and it's going to the safety driver is sitting in the back of the car. But as soon as the technology performs successfully, the safety driver will be taken out also, perhaps in a few months. Uber and GM Cruise, GM acquired this software company, and they're developing together. They announced that similar deployment plans in 2019 in urban cities. These are actually public commercial services. Robotaxis are going to utilize a lot of cloud assets, which will be hosted by many different robot systems, the cars. Many players are demonstrating minimum viable systems and kind of rushing into bring them out to the market. The problem is whether such different systems would scale to host all different suppliers, technologies, services, and assets necessary to enable robotaxi operations at scale. So if you go look at China, Baidu, the Google of China, they built an open development platform called Apollo 2.0 last year. Since then, the partners developing their solutions on top of common platform exponentially increased. It is showing that the Chinese companies are open to collaborating and working together and sharing data in China for autonomous driving. This is much harder in Western world. Baidu partnership ecosystem is basically exploding with all the benefits China provides. The open source strategy, they also call it China Speed, and even Chinese government has endorsed the Apollo project as the official autonomous vehicle platform for China. In other part of the world, these open autonomous mobility platform activities actually growing as well among these AV development communities, because it becomes very clear that one company can do it all, and more people are advocating for modular approach in developing self-driving vehicles. So two tier ones earlier this year at CES, Visteon and Harman, a Samsung company now, both previewed their development platform with really strong pitch in modular development of both the hardware and software. Their hardware platform is designed to have swappable components to work with different chipsets from many different suppliers. They also highlighted how their platform is open and modular to all kinds of software and algorithms coming from different sources. While Uber is actually, their system is vertically integrated, Lyft, on the other hand, has opened their self-driving system platform and hosted many developer partners so that they can utilize Lyft operating there. Now, in talking about self-driving cars and operating robo-taxis, these transportation network companies, Uber, Lyft, Didi, these are at the center. These TNCs are partnered with many self-driving software companies, new robo-car manufacturers, and even traditional auto OEMs. Uber, Lyft, Didi all have their own self-driving R&D centers and basically trying out different test vehicles from these OEMs and self-driving software companies to make better choices eventually for their own robotaxi operation. On the other hand, the traditional auto companies, you can see Toyota, GM here, traditional auto companies are hedging their bets in robotaxi businesses to complement their core businesses, which is selling their cars to privately owned purposes, but not knowing exactly what this is shaping up to. But they can't afford not to partner and invest. If the previous slide was all about R&D strategic partnership, this slide is about actual production partnerships and timelines. Once used to be a gaming PC processor maker NVIDIA and camera-based perception algorithm and vision processor provider Mobileye, these two are most important players because the computing power of automated driving system is getting more important ever. These two chip makers are basically quarterbacking the development of autonomous driving systems. They are splitting level three highway pilot production partnerships. These L3 production programs are targeting 2019-20 timelines. These are mostly personally owned, partially automated vehicles from traditional automakers. But in terms of robotaxi design wins, is coming in 2019, including Uber. NVIDIA partnered with NVIDIA is supplying this very powerful computer, Pegasus, which is basically two times more than the computer for the personally owned vehicle manufacturer's vehicles. So, just to give you my summary here, the key takeaways are: the personal car ownership will definitely change, and many consumers will use robotaxis for efficiency and economy. Top of missions to bring these automated cars for safety and social benefits, TNCs and OEMs are seeing economic incentives to make and operate robotaxis. There's a as I said, this, we are immediately seeing all these deployment, Waymo, and other robo-taxi companies and, you know, in different states. DSI sees very significant momentum because we are talking with all the suppliers and academia, government officials. It's definitely, there's a momentum going on. And from technology research companies' perspective, we are very excited about the momentum. Minnesota is going to be a top place to operate automated vehicles, mainly because of one of the biggest challenges of AV technologies, increment weather. But it's also the opportunity for, and we need to solve that problem, and it's being developed by many suppliers. I believe Minnesota is a pretty good place to test out and validate the systems. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Kim. We have run out of time with you, and I know Joan Wilshire has asked for the last 5 minutes, but thank you so much for your exciting testimony about some of the nuances of this exciting venture. So if Ms. Wilshire would please come forward. Again, if you have more questions from VSI or Mr. Kim, please contact Joe Marble, and he will get that information to you. Thank you, Ms. Wilshire, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and who you represent and give us
a good afternoon. Coverage. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I'm going to make this quick. I wrote a short version and even a shorter version, so you're lucky. The handout that I give you, I'll just go over briefly at the end here, but self-driving cars will change the world for everyone. But the most dramatic impact could be for people with disabilities and for people who are aging, provided that their needs are understood and technology solutions are paired to meet with such needs. It's all about level four. You heard it from our previous speaker. And if anything you leave from today's meeting, it's level four. That's what Minnesota needs to implement into their autonomous vehicle legislation as we move forward. That is what's going to be helpful for people with disabilities, ranging from intellectual disabilities, people who are blind, all different types of disabilities, and aging. As we age, that is going to be imperative. So you, the legislators, and other government powers, you know, have an opportunity here to guarantee that autonomous vehicles contribute to a more inclusive, economically stable, and independent life for people with disabilities, seniors, and veterans as well. So the handout before you, much of the information came from a National Council on Disability, and they did a report back in 2015, and it's still very, very relevant, talking about, well, I like the quote in the beginning there from a Google representative, talking about what do you do as you get older? You know, the daughter takes away your keys, and then what? You know, life just keeps going downhill, and there's a lot of vibrant individuals out there that certainly could use this. It talks about the current state of technology, and again, level four, that's we've got to get to, and the rest just talk about some of the potential barriers that might be, we might be looking at. Certainly driver's licensure, we'll have to take a look at that issue down the road and so forth. And the discrimination potential, I think, is something that the language and so forth will have to be looking at that. And the National Council on Disability, they have recommendations that they are urging states to follow. And so far, it looks like we're doing a good job doing just that. Do you have any questions?
Thank you so much. And the report that Director Wilshire is talking about is in your packet. If you need to look at that, refer that. We have time for 1 minute's worth of questions, if somebody has a question. If not, thank you. Representative Benardi has one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have for you is regarding the fleet of vehicles. So the one model that was about one-minute demand that people would be able to get a vehicle. Do you see that as being a service that would help people with a disability to be able to get into those cars, or will it be a different model for people who have a disability that need accessible devices to be able to get into a car?
Ms. Wiltshire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. I see fleets of autonomous vehicles being the way it's going to be. I don't really see us owning these, per se. So the fleet of vehicles for individuals with disabilities, seniors, et cetera, would be ideal for someone when they need it to do something spur of the moment now, almost on demand, which they don't have right now. Uber and Lyft, they don't have accessible vehicles. So, again, disabilities are left out. And because I sit on all these wonderful committees in the state, non-emergency medical transportation, the Minnesota Council on Transportation, aging and people with disabilities are constantly left out. And we don't always get the best services. And I see tremendous cost savings for the state of Minnesota for the non-emergency medical transportation. That is this, the medical service you get when you're on Medicaid and medical assistance. It's the drivers, whether it's a taxi or paying for a bus, will get you to your appointment. And there's quite a bit of fraud still in there. They're cleaning it up. But this would certainly take care of that immediately, because the car would just come up to your place and you'd have to jump in to go to your appointment. There wouldn't be an opportunity for you to go to the Mall of America first before you went to the medical appointment. So I see great savings on so many ends, from the state alone to the individual finally being able to get to where they need to go.
Representative South, do you have a 30-second question? I'll let you be the final. No? All right. Well, thank you for all your testimony. Thank you for yours coming here. This meeting is adjourned. Oh, before we go, the next meeting, next Tuesday, we'll be back in our own room down in the basement on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. So with that, the meeting is